Great to have you listening in here on WPR News. Time to take a look at the world of insects. Lots going on today, and PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, is back to talk about the insects we're seeing. We'll take a look at monarch butterflies. We'll take a look at, all kinds of things. Fireflies, for sure. I want to talk about Asian longhorn beetles, and I definitely want to talk about Wisconsin Insect Fest, which is coming up August 1st, and we'll get some more details about it as we go along. I see there's one title, one presentation on sex, violence, and deception, the hidden world of wetland insects. I'll get some more details on that a little bit later from PJ. But first, PJ, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here today, Larry.
Let's turn our attention to monarchs first. Monarchs have declined in recent years. I heard there's been a bit of an uptick this year.
Yeah, a bit of an uptick. And it's always hard to gauge monarch numbers, especially this time of the year. And so you can go out in your yard, you can wander around town or just about anywhere in the state, and you maybe are seeing monarchs, maybe you're not. But when you think about the eastern monarch population, they range across essentially the entire eastern half of the country.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard to gauge and kind of estimate and count their numbers this time of the year. So the meter stick, so to speak, that scientists use as we wait for them to migrate down to Mexico. And they go to these mountainous areas outside of Mexico City, and they cram together on these trees, packed very, very densely, thousands of them together on individual trees. And rather than counting the actual butterflies, what scientists do is they basically kind of estimate and measure the area occupied by the overwintering butterflies. And so that's the measuring metric that we use. And so every winter, scientists can do that. Some good news for the current moment is we did see basically a doubling of overwintering area. So their numbers do seem to be up. That's a bit of good news. However, if you look at the amount of area occupied last winter, it was about 1.79 hectares. And a hectare is 2.5 acres. So that's not a huge area when you think about it. All the monarchs from the entire eastern half of the U.S. crammed together into these small areas, like the size of your neighborhood, basically. The average for about the last 10 years is about 2.8 hectares. So we're down from that. And if you were to look at a longer time span, like the last 30 or so years, there's definitely a downward trend.
Yeah.
So there's some concerns out there about monarch populations.
Well, and of course, milkweed's the only plant the monarchs lay their eggs on.
Yeah, that is their food, their host plant. They need those milkweed plants. And there's, of course, various types and species of milkweeds, and they'll go to a range of them. But that's at the heart of their life cycle. And so one very simple thing is if you want to help monarchs, planting more milkweed in your yard, in your neighborhood, maybe if you attend, say, municipal board meetings and things like that, see if you can get your town or city or municipality to get on board with planting milkweed in parks and other areas like that so that we can provide some resources for monarchs.
Yeah, some cities have done a really nice job of that.
They have, yeah, and especially the last decade or so, there's really been this push to plant milkweed. But I will say there are still some municipalities that I've bumped into where they may have some rules on the books regarding noxious weeds that could be decades old. And in some locations, milkweed can be on that list, and you're not supposed to plant it. And so I would hope over time there would be change because that milkweed is so critical for monarchs. And I'll say other insects as well that specifically rely on those plants to go about and complete their life cycle.
Once again, there's some legislation to designate the monarch butterfly as Wisconsin State Butterfly. What do you think of that idea?
I think that's great to hear about, Larry. You know, every state has their own favorite insect or butterfly that they picked. I just feel that the monarch is such a charismatic species. I mean, pretty much everyone is going to love monarch butterflies. And so I think that's great to hear about that. Also, you know, when we recognize the insects like that and their importance, and give them that recognition, you know, then it's easier to buy in and kind of feel, hey, this is our state butterfly perhaps, and we want to do things to help it out. And so I think that could be a win-win in the long run.
Yeah, I don't know why. Well, there have been a couple of previous attempts, I think, but they failed. The bill failed for a lack of support.
So. Yeah, I've heard about that. I don't know all the details of that process and ins and outs, and sometimes things can move kind of slow, but hopefully this time around that may go through.
You can join in, by the way. If you have an insect question, I hope you will. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And if you have an insect photo, maybe an ID, we can handle that as well. You can email that in to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear those, see those as well. Fireflies are another insect population I think many people love to see and talk about. And I've seen a lot more this summer, it seems like.
Yeah. You're not alone, Larry. This has been one of the best years I can recall for quite a while for fireflies. Now, fireflies themselves seem to do very well when we have kind of damp conditions. The larvae feed on creatures like slugs. We know slugs like moisture, slugs like damp vegetation, things like that they feed on. Fireflies love the same habitat. And so when we look back over the last 5 or so years at our weather patterns, we've had some very dry and droughty periods, and that can be hard on fireflies in a lot of areas. Now, even during dry years, if you were in the right spot, like a creek or river valley mm-hmm. in the driftless region of the state, you could still bump into decent numbers of them. But this year, and really starting last year, we were getting a lot more rains. I think that's helped them out. And so I've been getting a lot of reports of very strong firefly numbers, which is great to see. I mean, those insects are very charismatic. Pretty much everyone grows up seeing fireflies, kind of experiencing the magic of those insects, probably, you know, catching them in an old peanut butter jar or something like that and keeping them as an overnight pet. And so who doesn't love fireflies? Just that that magic behind them is something really neat to see. I will say in my own neighborhood where I live, recently I went down, I'd been telling myself to do this for years, to go down and with my camera and tripod and do some long exposure photography of fire. And it was so much fun. I had to brave the mosquitoes, and I brought a head net with me. So if you have weather that's good for fireflies, fortunately, it's probably also going to be good for mosquitoes, that moisture component. But it does seem to be a good year for fireflies. I will add, though, just like the monarchs, there's concerns about fireflies as a whole. If we look at firefly numbers today, and if you can think back, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, the numbers we have today are likely down compared to in the past due to land use change, pesticide spraying, especially broad spectrum pesticide spraying types that is maybe done for mosquito yard treatments. There's concerns with that and the weather patterns. Dry weather just is not good for fireflies. So there are some concerns out there. If you want to help them out in your own yard, I'd say try to avoid or really limit pesticide use if you can.
Yeah.
And then one other thing, and I know sometimes lighting can add, you know, a lot of character to a yard, the aesthetic component, but they rely on light to find a mate and go about their biology. So light pollution is a concern for them. So leaving some of those lights off, you know, if you're sitting out on your back deck, enjoying a beverage or something, that's fine. But when you're done, turn them off so we're not disrupting those fireflies.
PJ Leash, our guest today, and we'll take some calls now. Mark in Sussex, we'll go to you first. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and great show as usual.
Thank you.
I was wondering, I have not seen any June bugs in at least southern Wisconsin. I asked a couple people, and nobody's seen any June bugs. I realize it's July, but at least in the southern part, I haven't seen any of the state.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're out there. Again, we are kind of past the period of activity for them. Another name for June bugs is May June beetles. So I was seeing plenty myself in southern Wisconsin during the months of May and June. As we get into later June, July, they basically disappear. You could, in theory, have an occasional rogue sighting here or there. As a whole, though, we have nearly 30 species of June bugs in Wisconsin. And they're not all widely distributed. Some of them are in certain corners of the state and not others. In general, the females like kind of weedy, grassy, turf grass type areas. So a classic place for them would be like fallow farm fields, meadows, places like that. And if you're in a fairly urban suburban area, you may not have great habitat for them. Another component is that with our June bugs in Wisconsin, almost all of them have a three-year life cycle. There's one species, Philophaga tristis, that has a two-year life cycle. Otherwise, they have a three-year life cycle. And what that can mean is in your given spot, you may have a banner crop, so to speak, one year, and then things might be relatively quiet the next 2 years. And then in the third year in the cycle, boom, you have a bunch of them again. So there can be a lot of variation, both geographically or spatially, and also over time as well. But definitely some June bugs were out in the state this year, but by now they're basically done with their activity as the adult stage.
There you go, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Let's take a call from Peter in Appleton. Hi, Peter.
Hi. A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I were down on a beach in Port Washington, and she got bit by what she described as a little tiny red bug, probably not much bigger than a pinhead. But it was very itchy, left a red mark, and a larger red mark, maybe about the size of a dime, formed. That eventually went away, but she still got this spot where the bug bite was. Any idea what that could have been?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, a couple of things come to mind. There are creatures called chiggers, which are technically a small reddish type of mite. They are actually parasites of other animals. They can kind of inadvertently bite humans and cause skin irritation, but usually you wouldn't notice it. Some of our tick species can be reddish. There's always some other oddball possibility. So in my mind, without seeing the actual creature, really hard to pin down exactly what it might have been. Another caveat in a case like this is everybody's skin reacts differently to mosquito bites or black fly bites or this or that. And so there's no good way to be able to just look at a bite or hear a description and figure out a cause in most cases, which makes it a little bit tough.
Peter, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. PJ Leash, our guest today. He has degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the UW-Madison, and he's manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of insects in Wisconsin with our guest, PJ Leash, from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Callers online, so let's go to the phones again, and Scott in Summit Lake. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. You mentioned planting milkweed. Besides throwing them on the ground and having them blow away, how can you get them to grow in a specific spot?
Yeah, good question. Personally, I have had some challenges with milkweed, myself growing it from like young, small transplants. Part of that may be rabbits and other things in yards or squirrels just digging in the area. What I've found a lot of success with in my own yard has been to purchase some plants that are a bit more established in pots and go with those. And then they seem to catch on very quickly. And my impression is once you get those established in the ground, within a year or two, they really start taking off and you get shoots popping up here and there. And then it can almost be more of a matter of selectively, controlling the shoots so that it doesn't take over your entire perennial bed. But if you're having struggles with it, finding a plant nursery near you that has some of our native milkweed plants can be a really good route to go.
I think that's great advice. Scott, there you go. Thank you for calling. Michael in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Michael.
One day old. I'll take it.
Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am. I just wanted to put something out for the listeners of your program that I've naturalized my yard for the last 20 years. I haven't mown. And now I kind of live in the woods and I have all kinds of insects and all kinds of other critters, and it does a lot for the environment. It does a lot for insects, and also I don't have to use fossil fuels to mow the lawn, create pollution, And there's a lot more of that now than there was, say, even 20 years ago. I live in Madison, and as I'm driving around today, there are a lot of naturalized yards, and it does an awful lot for the community. And so I want to thank you for the program, and I hope the listeners take this to heart because it's a great thing to do.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Yeah, and I feel there can be a lot of benefits to that that approach. So I really think it's great to hear that. We have so many insects that rely on plants for part of their life cycle. They may be herbivores feeding directly on plants, or if they're, say, predators or parasites, they may be targeting some of the insects on those plants. So in general, the more plants you have in your yard and the more plant diversity, that's going to help out a wider range of insects. As the caller, Michael, mentioned, you know, there can be other benefits, too. If you don't have that traditional turf grass lawn and you don't have to mow it, well, you have more time because you don't have to go out and mow. And this time of the year, it seems to be once, twice a week almost. And there can all around be a lot of benefits. I think this idea is really getting some traction. I know other states like Minnesota, there's a program to encourage folks to establish bee lawns, which have wildflowers incorporated, a lot less mowing and things like that. And as I said, there can be a lot of win-win benefits from situations like that.
Let's go to Jim in rural Wausau next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. We have a serious problem with Japanese beetles this year. It's the worst I've ever seen. And they have just about decimated all my grapevines. And I've tried several insecticides on them, and they just seem to like it. So I was wondering, is there maybe the best insecticide to control them on grapevines?
Yeah, they love grapevines.
They do. I mean, Japanese beetles feed on over 300 different types of plants. And if you made a gigantic list, grapevines would probably be up in about the top five or top 10 for sure. Jim, what have you sprayed at this point? I'm curious.
I tried dead bug, which is a BT spray to start with. And then I tried a bear product, a Cytruthin, I think it is. And I was thinking maybe seven would work.
Okay. Yeah, so the Dead Bug Brew, which is Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew is the name of the product, that contains the ingredient spinosad, which generally doesn't seem to work very well against Japanese beetles. It seems to do an okay job with other beetles, but just seems to struggle with Japanese beetles. So not too surprising there. For the other products you mentioned, the beta-cyfluthrin and the newer formulation of seven for the last, gosh, 5-8 years or so. It used to contain carbaryl. Now it contains one of the pyrethroid ingredients, which is the same class as the cyfluthrin I just mentioned. That will generally work. You have to understand the limitations, though. It only is going to work for about a week or two, so you may have to apply, observe, see if the beetle pressure is still high, spray again. Also, grapevines, if they are growing rapidly, they're putting out new leaves all the time, and you're only protecting the leaves that you sprayed. And so if you spray today and over the next week or so, you have new leaves pop out, those new tender leaves that are very succulent and attractive to the Japanese beetles, they have not been sprayed, and so they are not protected. And so that could be playing a role in the management here. One other thing to consider is that grapes and a lot of other plants, they're surprisingly resilient. If you go to a commercial vineyard, they are pruning leaves off all the time, and those plants just chug along. So the point I want to make is those plants can actually withstand quite a bit of feeding damage from Japanese beetles, like 20, 30% defoliation before your yields, i.e. the number of grapes, the size of the grape clusters and things like that, really seems to take a hit. And so keep that in mind. You don't need to be out there with the approach of trying to eradicate every Japanese beetle. I take much more of the approach of let's limit the damage, kind of slow it down a bit so that those plants can be protected. You still get your yields. Now, depending on how big your grape patch is, one thing you could try if it's not very big, if you can track down some fine mesh netting and physically cover the top of the plants, that would act as a physical barrier so that they cannot get to and feed on the leaves. Now, if you've got a long stretch of grapes, that's not going to be an option, but smaller vineyard patch, that could work.
Yeah, it could. It could indeed. Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Just on the opposite end, Richard in Norwalk sent an email to ask if Japanese beetle populations rise and fall. Richard says he hasn't seen very many near them when he used to see a lot of them in Norwalk.
Yeah, so it's been interesting because Japanese beetles are an insect that I have been studying and working with for close to two decades at this point. Years ago, as a graduate student and a researcher on campus, I did a lot of hands-on experiments. If you go back, say, about 15 years ago in Madison, for example, you could drive by our mall on the west side and identify linden trees from about a mile away because they have that, that conical shape. Every leaf was skeletonized. The trees were brown. And now I see some around, not very bad, though. So there can be some natural kind of ebbing and flowing of populations. In general, for the last five or so years, what I've seen is that in many parts of southern Wisconsin, and there's variability, but many parts of southern Wisconsin, their numbers have gone down quite a bit compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago. So that's good news. When you get up to Highway 29, that Wausau area, like our last caller, on up, that's where we're seeing the bigger numbers these days.
Yeah, I think I've seen two Japanese beetles this year, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're out there, but in some spots, not too bad, whereas in other areas, if you haven't bumped into them before and you're in Wausau or Merrill or Eau Claire or Green Bay, they can be pretty bad out there at the moment.
Tim in La Crosse, we'll go to you now. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. I've got ants coming into my kitchen. They're very small. I suspect they're probably in the wall behind the kitchen sink. I think there may be feral ants from what I can tell, and I'm just wondering what can I do to get rid of them?
Yeah, a little bit tough, especially if you're seeing some small ants. And the first thing I would mention was if you haven't done any spraying yet, don't start. Hold off on that. We do have certain ants, like feral ant, that if you spray, they can do something weird where you have your ant colony and it basically splits into two. And now you're chasing two fires to put out instead of one. So the first step I would say is we should figure out exactly which ant you're dealing with because each ant can be managed a little bit differently. If we can figure out the ant species, and by all means, I'd encourage you to collect some of the ants in maybe a small container, send them into me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And that way I can look at them under the microscope, let you know exactly what they're, and then we can fine-tune our management approaches. In many situations, we can maybe use a bait. Again, depending on the ant species, sprays may or may not be a good option, but until we know the ant species, it's a little hard to provide some good, reliable management advice.
And there's instructions on, if you type in UW Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, you'll get some information there on where to send and so forth. And with a really small ant like that, sometimes you get photos.
I do, yeah. And in larger ants, I can sometimes pick out from photos. If it's a really tiny ant, we're talking like under a tenth of an inch long, a 16th of an inch. It's just hard. I mean, for really small ants, there's two species that very difficult to tell apart from photos, the feral ant and the thief ant. The thief ant, I've had some recent cases. That one's also sometimes called the grease ant. They love kind of fatty type foods. And so one thing you could try is if you cut out like a little piece of wax paper and try putting on one like a dab of peanut butter, on another one a little drop of cooking oil, see if they go to that. That could be something you could try. And if they do like that, you could go to the hardware store and pick out an ant bait that says on the packaging that it's for like fat or protein-loving ants and try that.
Let's take another call. Scotty in Manitowoc, thank you for calling. Scotty, are you there? Well, let's take a call from Tom in Green Bay then. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, one question. How many different kinds of mosquitoes do we have in Wisconsin? First of all.
Okay, and then.
Secondly, second question is a comment that if you turn off all your lights outside, you know, make sure your windows are dark, you got a whole lot less spider webs under your soffit, let me tell you.
Okay.
So for the first question, mosquito species in the state, it's right around 56 mosquito species. And some of these can be very common and widespread. Some of them are restricted to specific habitats. Like one of my favorite mosquito species is actually the pitcher plant mosquito, and it develops inside pitcher plants and bogs up north. Doesn't bite humans. And so it's just kind of this quirky, interesting species. Other ones are widespread and can really kind of ruin picnics and outdoor activities. Regarding the lights, that is a really great point. I mean, we said lights can interfere with things like fireflies, other nocturnal insects like moths and other things that are out after dark. But also, spiders catch on. If we have lights on and that is drawing insects in, spiders can set up shop right next to that light because they get an easy meal. And so if the lights are off, you're not attracting insects. That may help you decrease spiders around your house as well.
James emailed to say they live on the Baraboo River, where they discovered the giant stonefly, an insect they'd never known before, and wondered if you what you could tell us about giant stoneflies.
Yeah, so giant stoneflies, I don't see that often. And if you haven't seen these, they're good-sized insects, maybe about an inch and a half long. They're kind of dark-colored, grayish, brownish-blackish, but they'll have some orange on the body, especially kind of the pronotum or neck region, if you will. Look almost a little bit prehistoric, if you will, just with the sheer size. They develop in clean, fast-moving bodies of water. So you have a river there. I used to bump into these around Memorial Day weekend. I would often go up with friends and whitewater raft on the Wolf River north of Shawnee, which was always a fun trip. And we'd be going down the river and sometimes see those. So I always have fond memories when I see these insects. It takes me back to the whitewater rafting trips. But they can serve as a general indicator of good water quality. If you have really polluted rivers and streams, they're just not going to do well in those habitats. So that can be a good thing about seeing them, as it tells you you've got some decent water quality near you.
Yeah, and you know what? Louie in La Crosse has something that kind of relates to all this. Let's go there. Louie, hi.
Hi, yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about mayflies. So I grew up in La Crosse, and my family has a cabin on the Mississippi River, and I was always told as a kid, big mayfly hatches are a good indicator of a healthy river. I'm just curious, what are some of the factors that play into what a healthy river is that makes a mayfly hatch so massive?
Yeah, so a couple of things that come to mind when I think about, you know, water quality. You could have pollutants that could be from man-made activities, you know, petroleum-based products and things like that getting into river. You could also have situations where if you have, say, agricultural runoff and that gets into the water and that leads to algal blooms and things like that, that can impact water quality. That could impact oxygen concentration in the water potentially. We have all these aquatic insects, and some of them have very high oxygen demands. And for water, generally, the colder the water, you can have more oxygen. So think of like nice, clean, cold trout streams. You have certain insects there that aren't going to do well in big polluted rivers. And so, again, there's a lot of factors that can influence that. But we do know certain insects can do okay in kind of dirtier water. Some of them really need cleaner water. And there was an entomologist here on campus back in the 1990s, Dr. Bill Hilsenhoff, who was an aquatic entomologist, and he actually really sat down and looked at all these factors and came up with what's called the Hilsenhoff Biotic Index, where you could be a biologist, go out and survey the insects that are present and use that information to basically gauge water quality, which is really cool when you think about it.
Yeah, very, very cool. Louie, thank you so much for calling. Robert in Amherst Junction, what's on your mind?
Hi there. Thank you. I met my wife rafting, whitewater rafting on the Wolf River.
Cool.
So I actually had two questions, one about apple trees, but the other is about these lights that people put out. And canoeing down the river, I'm just noticing all these houses along the river, and they've got these bug zappers. And I know that what they want to do is they want to kill insects they don't like. But do those bug zappers attract biting insects, or do they just attract harmless insects?
Yeah, so answer to that is basically both. You will draw in some biting insects like mosquitoes. Mosquito researchers do have traps that are somewhat similar, but they're designed to be much more specific to mosquitoes versus the larger kind of bug zappers. You'll get some mosquitoes, but mostly you're going to be attracting and zapping and killing other kind of incidental things, moths, various flies, and things like that. So there's a lot of kind of bycatch, if you will, or non-target impacts from those zappers. And from what I've seen in the literature, they're probably not really helping with mosquito numbers or mosquito bites that you're experiencing, and they're probably doing more harm than good.
Yeah. You had another question, I believe, Robert?
Yeah, you know, so one of the things that is recommended or that you read about with apple trees and particularly apple maggot fly is to put out little round discs with tanglefoot on them. But that is a really labor-intensive and messy process. And I'm just wondering, I mean, I've also heard that that's only a way to monitor the numbers, not really to impact the population.
Yeah, it depends a little bit on context. So you can buy what are called red sphere traps, and it's basically like a plastic ball or sphere, and you cover it with tanglefoot, which if you haven't worked with, it's just these,
oh,
these
horribly awful.
Sticky stuff. So you basically have this big red sticky ball. You hang it in the canopy of the trees. Depends on the context, so in terms of monitoring versus control. So if you have, say, a large orchard, you're not going to be able to get control with that. But you could put out those traps. That could alert you. If you keep an eye on them, you'd say, oh, gosh, apple maggot is now active, so I'm going to implement some other management approaches. If you have a tree, apple tree, or maybe just a couple trees in your yard, and you put out a bunch of these, as you mentioned, it is kind of labor-intensive, but if you have relatively large numbers, and that might be 3, 4, 5 of these per apple tree, that can actually provide some control in that context. So you have to look at how many trees you have and kind of that ratio of these traps to the trees.
Robert, thank you very much for calling. And on to Scotty in Manitowoc. Hi, Scotty.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I raise monarch butterflies in a little three little tents in my house. I get the eggs from my garden. I have, butterfly weed and various kinds of milkweed. And this year I have an abundance of butterfly eggs, and I'm afraid my population may be a bit larger than the one swamp plant, milkweed plant that I have. Will they eat other milkweed plants, or do I have to stick with exactly the type of plant that I find the caterpillar on? Will a caterpillar from a swamp milkweed also eat butterfly weed?
Yeah, good question. I suspect that they would. So you can certainly try that, especially if you're getting low on the one type of milkweed that they had been started on. One challenge, though, with caterpillars, and kind of what you're getting at with the question, is sometimes if you start them on one plant and you switch them to something else, they may not like that. Now, when I think of that sort of situation, I'm thinking more of species that can feed on a wide range of trees. And so if you start them feeding on apple and you switch to something very different, like maple trees, they may not like that. I would suspect, though, in this case, if you tried just two different milkweed species, they may go for that second one because yeah, those milkweeds are very closely related.
Scotty, good luck with that. Thank you very much for calling. PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Coming up at noon, we'll be talking about the diversity and complexity of bird calls with a UW-Madison researcher, and we'll have a few calls for you to listen to as well as we talk with the researcher. So looking forward to that. Right now, The World of Insects with P.J. Leash. And P.J., before we get away from time here, I wanted to mention the Wisconsin Insect Fest, which is August 1st this year. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this, Larry. This is an event that the UW-Madison Entomology Department has been hosting for about 5 or so years at this point, and we've moved it around to various locations in the state. This year, I'm very pleased to announce we are partnering with Olbrich Botanical Gardens here in Madison, Wisconsin, on the east side of town. And the event is Friday, August 1st in the afternoon from 1 until 6 p.m., This is a free, family-friendly event. We've got some activities suitable for kids all the way up to grown-ups. We've got a number of insect booths, about a dozen or so booths with various activities and outreach-type things. But we've got a great lineup of speakers for talks, guided walks outdoors, and a bunch of other fun stuff. The talks are going to range from everything from a workshop on insect photography with someone who's just a spectacular photographer, Kevin Hanley. We've got seminars on natural history of fireflies, bog creatures, bog insects, one of my favorite topics, wild solitary bees and things like that. I'm going to be talking about cicadas as well. I will say this is a free event, but space is limited. And so if you head to the website for Olbrich Botanical Gardens and look for events on August 1st, you'll find a page with sign up for it. Or we have a page on the UW Entomology website. You can go to the URL go.wisc.edu/insectfest. And there's RSVP buttons. You can just click that. It's free to reserve your seats because we got limited space. But again, this is going to be Friday, August 1st, Wisconsin Insect Fest at Olbrich Botanical Gardens here in Madison. And I'm really hoping to have a lot of you turn up to check out some fun insect activities.
Yeah, and come early and take a walk through Olbrich because it's a beautiful time of the year to be there.
It is, and actually that entire day at Olbrich, there's other insect activities going on. There's an event called Butterfly Action Day about butterfly conservation, so there's booths for that. There's also a blooming butterflies exhibit where you can pay a little bit and go in and experience live butterflies, which is really cool. So you could come spend the entire day at Olbrich and just have a spectacular time learning about and experiencing insects.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I'm a member over there, so I can get into those for free.
Nice.
Oh, boy. Well, I hope you get a big turnout, and I'm sure you will. It's going to be a lot of fun, for sure. Stephanie in Madison has something relating to monarchs, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I used to also raise monarch caterpillars indoors, and I was kind of doing some research because I was concerned if this is, you know, an okay practice or if there's any concerns of like the viability of the butterflies after raising them indoors. I've heard maybe like they aren't able to migrate as well. And I was curious if you have any thoughts about raising monarchs. I know you can have like a setup outdoors, you can have a setup indoors. I'm curious if you have any insights into that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. And personally, I have some very mixed feelings about raising monarchs. As you mentioned, there can be some concerns. One thing that comes to mind is if we are using the same cage or enclosure to raise a whole bunch of caterpillars, the monarch caterpillars can become infected with various pathogens. And so if they are all together in the same cage, sharing some of the same food, it's possible that they could be spreading diseases to one another. And you may not know it, but if the adult that emerges is weakened and it can't make it to Mexico, you know, that could be a concern. We also have some data from published studies about raising them indoors. And basically, they get a little out of sync with the natural cycles, the movement of the sun and things like that. And that might impact their ability to navigate. So that would be a concern, especially later in the summer when you have that generation that is going to be migrating down to Mexico in the fall. And so, again, very mixed feelings about this. On one hand, though, raising monarchs can be a really neat and great experience, educational-wise. It's a way to get children and adults, for that matter, really interested, and they can take a close look at that life cycle. So there's definitely some educational benefit. My own thoughts about this is if you want to raise small numbers of them indoors for educational purposes, to show family members and friends, that's great. There can be a lot of benefit to that. But if you are trying to raise large numbers of them indoors, if you aren't doing it quite right, there definitely can be some concerns for the health of the butterflies and also their ability to navigate.
Yeah. Stephanie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Bridget in La Crosse had emailed us, and you were saying that you were going to be talking about cicadas, and she has a question relating to cicadas. Their birthday mid-July, all their life they've heard of the cicadas calling, knew the birthday was coming, and Bridget's wondering if the 12-plus inches of rain we had in late June had an impact. They've seen plenty of monarchs and a very good number of fireflies. Are the annual cicadas just late for the first time ever?
Yeah, good question. I mean, one thing I had been looking at, and I do this every year, but I'll keep a close eye on what we call growing degree days. It's a way to basically gauge how much heat we have accumulated over the course of the growing season. If you go back a month or so ago before that heat wave we had in June, we were a little bit behind average. Now, I think we've certainly caught up a bit more. But sometimes there can be some local factors if you are in a valley or something like that, and it's just a little bit cooler for that local microclimate. That could perhaps delay things. So it's very possible that they might just be delayed a little bit in your given area. I will say here in the Madison area, I've heard of a lot of cicadas buzzing from trees. I know the eastern cicada killer wasps are out, and that's a wasp that specifically hunts cicadas and is synced up pretty well time-wise. So they're out in other parts of the state. I would have a suspicion they might not be out just quite yet, but probably will be very soon in your area. I do wonder about the rain, though. In terms of a very heavy rain, if you had some soils that were waterlogged for long periods of time, that could potentially be bad for insects because cicadas spend their life cycle mostly below ground feeding on tree roots. And so if they were submerged in saturated soil for a long time, that probably would be hard on them as well.
Angela in Bailey's Harbor emailed to ask if earwigs on their milkweed are a serious threat to monarch caterpillars and eggs. Angela doesn't normally spray for any insects, wondering if some homemade traps would be beneficial. Said they also read about insects, specifically bees, getting stuck in the milkweed and dying. Can you elaborate on any of this? Angela wonders. And she shared a couple of photos of monarch caterpillars.
Nice. Yeah, we've got some great photos up here in the studio at the moment. In terms of the earwigs, earwigs have interesting habits. They are omnivores. So you can go out after dark and sometimes see earwigs feeding on plants in your yard. I was out just a night or two ago and saw this in my own garden. They also can be scavengers and even predators at time to a certain extent. And so there's a possibility if you had just a lot of earwigs on and around your milkweed plants, I can't rule out the possibility that they might try to feed on those eggs. One very simple thing you could do, well, two things actually come to mind. You could try some of the traps. You can make your own with like a little empty tuna can and things like that on the ground. You could put down an old shingle or something, give them a hiding spot during the daytime, flip that over and squish them or something like that. But they're often pretty easy to knock off of plants. And so if you see them on leaves, especially after dark, you could take a container of soapy water, knock them down into that. If you feel that it's warranted. In terms of the stickiness, milkweeds actually have some interesting pollen and floral structures. And I've seen pictures where something like a honeybee has gone to a milkweed flower for nectar and pollen, and they get some of these structures stuck to them. And often you get kind of this chain of floral parts stuck to their leg. So there is that definitely that sticky component there as well.
I wanted to be sure to mention Asian longhorn beetles because the DNR is asking people to keep an eye out for them, and they're kind of easy to spot.
Yeah, they are. So if you haven't heard of the Asian longhorn beetle before, just do an internet search for that. They're very large, distinctive members of the longhorned beetle family Cerambycidae. They're big. They're like close to an inch and a half long or so, jet black with kind of the starry night pattern. It's a pretty insect.
White spots.
To look at. Yeah, white spots, white bands on the antennae. They are a concern because they're an invasive species. They can attack a wide range of trees, especially maples they seem to like, but other hardwood trees as well. There are some issues with them in the eastern U.S., so it's definitely something we want to be aware of. Am I expecting it to show up in the state this year? No, not necessarily. And actually, if you look at the Midwest historically, Chicago at one point had an issue with these, and folks there were able to eradicate Asian longhorn beetle from Chicago. So this does seem to be an insect that with enough effort, you can fight back against it compared to something like emerald ash borer, a lot harder to do. So that's some good news about it. But still, with insects like this, if they're invasive, we ideally want to catch them early to give us the best shot at eradicating them from our area. And this could have impacts on forested areas, but also urban forest as well.
So if you see one, what do you do?
Yeah, best thing to do in a case like this, I mean, you could certainly email me photos if you want so we can look at it. Otherwise, I would try to collect the specimen if you can. And also reach out to Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, or DATCAP, as we call them. They actually have a pest hotline where you can call and call in with reports of suspected invasive species, and then someone will follow up, and that might include a site visit if there's a suspicion of species like Asian longhorn beetle.
Let's go back to the Insect Fest for just a minute. Wisconsin Insect Fest on August 1st. That's at Olbrich Park. Are you a good photographer? There's insects?
I'd say decent. I've got a pretty good setup in my lab, macro photography lens, so I like to think I'm decent, but I know there's some folks that are a lot better photographers than I am, and we do have Kevin Hanley, who's a master naturalist, and he's going to be leading a workshop, so I'm very excited about that activity.
And again, go through the, it's August 1st, and it's in the afternoon, right?
Yep, 1 to 6 p.m., and if you want to find information about that, head to the Olbrich Garden website, or look up the UW Entomology website, or a short link for that is go.wisc.edu/insectfest.
I love the title of the one's talk, Sex, Violence, and Deception, The Hidden World of Wetland Insects.
Wow. Should be a fun time. All sorts of interesting creatures live in bogs. You have interesting carnivorous plants. You have all sorts of insects that rely on these various plants that are restricted to that very specific habitat. And it's a world that most folks never experience, because how many folks get their feet wet and wander out into bogs to take a close look?
Yeah, that's going to be a fun talk. And again, you do need to sign up.
Yes.
Because there is limited space.
Yes, yeah.
It's free, but you got to sign up.
Yep, exactly. So if you head to the website pages for it, there's free RSVP links. You can click those buttons and be able to reserve seats for yourself or your family. But again, space is limited, so don't delay.
Well, that's going to be a whole lot of fun, PJ, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I think we covered all of our questions, and there's one more. We can do this quickly, maybe. Marcia emailed to ask about morning glories. This year they're noticing skeletonized. Would insects be involved in that?
Most likely, yes. Morning glories, you know, skeletonization type damage. I would wonder about Japanese beetles. So keep an eye out during the daytime. If you don't see anything during the day, including taking a close look at topside, underside of leaves, I would suggest heading out after dark with a flashlight or headlamp and do some checking. Then sometimes there's insects that are primarily active at nighttime.
Thank you so much, PJ. PJ Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and we will have him back, and we will do this all over again. Coming up, we're going to talk about bird calls, bird songs. There's been some great and interesting research on it. We'll learn about it next. I'm Larry Mueller.